Hey, Ben.
Been around here today.
You're late.
Mr. Chairman, not Chief. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Break the handle.
Yeah. Call the House Finance Committee to order. Time is 1:37 on February 28th. Members present today are Representative Lancaster, Hudson, Foster, Bundy, Whitaker, Davies, and myself.
This is a little one.
Being shortly. On the schedule today, we have two bills and, up for consideration and an overview from overview presentation by DOT on Garvey bonds. We'll start first with House Bill 72. Assistant, get a thought on this.
Ready for a motion, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Moses is a.
Representative Foster.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. My name is Carol Carroll. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs.
Okay.
The bill you have before you, Mr. Chairman, would create a Assistant Adjutant General for the National Missile Defense System in Alaska. What the bill essentially does is set up a structure that the department could use if the whole system comes to fruition, as we believe it will. This position needs to be established by the legislature, because you are the only ones that can do that. We have two assistant adjutant generals at the moment, one for Air, one for Army Guard. This position would be federally funded in its entirety. It would exist during the development and deployment of the system in Alaska. It would be a member of the traditional guard in the state of Alaska. And in its active duty role, its full-time role, we believe that it would be the site commander for the development of national missile defense in Alaska. We believe it's very important, the department believes it's very important to have this position be an Alaskan and be a member of the Alaska National Guard. We would, because I think if that person is, we would have much better chance of gaining the jobs and the training that the Alaska National Guard needs in order to fill these positions that will be coming with the National Missile Defense. Mr. Chairman, that ends my testimony, and I would certainly be willing to answer any questions that I can.
Representative Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did I understand you say this would be someone who is currently a member of the Alaska National Guard?
Through the chair, Representative Bundy, no. There is no one currently in this position, but one of the requirements the department would, one of the requirements of the position would be whoever is in the position would be a member of the Alaska National Guard.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I guess, so you're taking, would it likely be then that someone who is currently a member of the Guard would be appointed to this position?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bundy, that is possible, but not necessarily the case.
Because then my follow-up question would be, is this is going to provide training. How is it that somebody put a new title on them, all of a sudden they have this new talent, so they can provide the training?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bundy, this position, as our commissioner foresees it acting, would be in the command of the deployment and the development of the national system in Alaska. He would have, being an Alaskan and being a member of the National Guard, a certain perspective. That perspective would be more likely to manage the affairs of the National Missile Defense System so that Alaskans would be hired into those jobs first, and that Alaskans would be provided the training that would be needed to really deploy the system in Alaska. And that is the objective of creating this structure for the department to be able to take advantage of those opportunities, essentially.
Are there any more questions? Representative Foster.
Yeah, what would a chain of command look like? In other words, who would this new general report to? Would that be to General Oates, the commissioner, or would that be to the governor, or to somebody in Washington, D.C.?
Through the chair, Representative Foster. In the traditional guard role, he would report to the adjutant general. In his role as a site activation commander, he would be working with the National Missile Defense Joint Program Office, which is the national military office in charge of the program.
Okay.
Representative Hudson.
I believe the sponsor statement indicates that exactly that, that the position would report to the Adjutant General.
Yes.
That's your question.
Any other questions? Representative Harris?
Maybe I misunderstood this morning. I think we had a name that was already forwarded. Is that correct? Has the governor already submitted a name for this position?
Representative Harris, if that's the case, I don't know about it.
I thought this morning we had a name put forward for this already. Maybe they were jumping the gun a little bit and making sure this passed.
There was a general name down there. I don't know what.
I think it was for this
position.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Harris, to my knowledge, no one has been chosen for this position. It's not even authorized at this point. But what the legislature does see are general officers' names that are already in the Alaska National Guard coming to you for confirmation for their rank. And you may have seen that. I am unaware of anybody being appointed to this position.
Okay, thank you. I may have misunderstood or misrepresented what's that.
Ready for motion, Mr. Chairman?
Are there any amendments? Representative.
No.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, an amendment that said this person would come within sight of Fairbanks or not. Never mind.
Representative Hudson.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill number 72. With the associated fiscal note out of the committee with individual recommendations, ask unanimous consent.
Any objection?
Just for a comment that not to the position, but as is often the case, people who are uncomfortable with the amount of spending in Alaska's total budget, this, even though it's not general funds, even though it's federal money, it will increase Alaska's total budget by $200,000 a year, and folks who just look at the bottom line of the total budget need to be aware of that. I remove my objection.
Any other objections or any comments? It's not supported. Next, we'll take up Senate Bill 16. If we could have Larry Dietrich come forward, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Larry Dietrich. I'm the director of the Division of Spill Prevention and Response for the Department of Environmental Conservation. To my left is Paul Foos. He's the marine technical contractor for the task force we'll be talking about this morning. And also, we should have online from Fairbanks the task force facilitator, Mr. Brian Rogers.
He's online, yes.
Journalist?
How did you want to handle this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if it's okay, I would. The department was tasked, our legislation was passed last year as being the chair of the task force under Senate Concurrent Resolution 1. And with your approval, I'll go ahead and give some prepared remarks to give an overview. And then we would follow that with some comments from Mr. Brian Rogers, who is the facilitator for the task force. And he will cover the sponsor statement. He'll highlight the findings of the task force that was included in a report that you should have in your packets, and he'll cover the sectional analysis, and then we're all available for questions at that point. Go ahead and proceed. Okay.
Please continue.
Thank you very much. Yeah, and Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm pleased to address you today on behalf of Commissioner Brown, who is the chair of the task force on motorized oil transport. Commissioner Brown served on the steering committee of the task force along with Senator Drew Pierce and Representative Pete Cott. The task force included a 23-member cross-section of the maritime industry, the Alaska Railroad, and other interested parties. The goal of this legislation is simple. It's to protect Alaska's renewable resources and keep Alaska's waters the cleanest and most pristine in the world by including large seagoing marine non-tank vessels and Alaska Railroad in Alaska's safety net for oil spill prevention and response. Alaska is the only West Coast state that does not include non-tank vessels in the oil spill safety net. In May of last year, the 21st Legislature debated and passed Senate Bill 273 and Senate Concurrent Resolution 1, which commissioned a task force on motorized oil transport to work out the details of how to implement oil spill contingency plans and achieve the response planning standard in a way that was acceptable to those who would be affected. The task force has completed the work directed by the legislature and achieved unanimous consensus on legislation to accomplish that. The consensus legislation is the CS for SB 16, which was developed by the task force and is predicated on no further amendments by the members. To give you a little more detail, although the requirement for financial responsibility was made effective last year, the requirement to have an oil spill contingency plan and meet the response planning standard was not. Instead, the legislature, through Senate Bill 273 and Senate Concurrent Resolution 1, commissioned the task force to determine how to implement the response planning standards and provide opportunities for streamlined oil spill contingency plans. Those standards were set by the legislature in SB 273 as the containment and control of 15% of the maximum oil capacity of a non-tank vessel or train within 48 hours and cleanup of the discharge within the shortest possible time, consistent with minimizing damage to the environment. Non-tank vessels were defined as self-propelled vessels over 400 gross tons, not including tank vessels, oil barges, or public vessels. Senate Concurrent Resolution 1 specified 23 members of the task force on motorized oil transport. This served to ensure a diversity of viewpoints and adequate representation of all groups to be regulated. The members included representatives from the U.S. Coast Guard, the Department, the Railroad, Spill Response Cooperatives, the Shipping Industry, Spot Charter Groups, the Fishing Industry, Regional Citizens Advisory Councils, and representatives from the crude oil industry and the refined oil distributors and transporters. Many more persons who were not appointed representatives attended the work group sessions and formal task force meetings. The task force held 11 formal meetings over a five-month period in which the members worked through legal and technical issues on prevention, contingency plans, and response planning standards. Three work groups were created to address specific areas of concern. The recommendations of the task force are practical. They meet the requirements the legislature established in last year's bill and include implementation measures that use a market-based economy approach to keep costs down. The recommendations are based on Alaska's existing oil spill response infrastructure and provide maximum flexibility for meeting the requirements. The work of the task force has already fostered private sector initiatives that significantly increase the resources that will be brought to bear on a spill. Alliances between ship agents, stevedoring companies, and spill response cooperatives are now being explored to meet the response needs, and a new marine exchange that covers all of Alaska is being created. Members of the task force were extremely attentive to the proceedings and assimilated a tremendous amount of information during their tenure. All meetings were very well attended, and the level of dialogue was frank, constructive, and productive. After careful and thorough consideration of all ideas and requests brought before them, they achieved unanimous consensus to support 31 individual recommendations. The task force also exhaustively reviewed the legal issues and meticulously identified what elements should be contained in regulation and what should be contained in statute. The bill you have before you is the end result of this detailed process, and it's the task force recommendation that it be adopted without amendment, recognizing that the legal language and details have all been agreed to, and an enormous amount of effort has gone into its formation. Overall, the bill is simple and straightforward in its approach. It fundamentally makes Senate Bill 273, passed by the legislature last year, effective while including immunity for participants and enabling language to support regulations detailing how it will be implemented. These regulations have effectively been negotiated through the task force proceedings and will be drafted consistent with the recommendations contained in the report. The cooperation between industry, state representatives, and lawmakers to develop recommendations that are practicable, reasonable, and economic is a tribute really to the task force members. The work provides a foundation for enhanced spill prevention and response preparedness, thereby ensuring our state resources and economy are adequately protected for future generations. In the end, the task force has successfully completed the work requested by the legislature and has produced through unanimous consent a report and recommendations for rulemaking that outline an acceptable means by which they will all participate in the state's oil spill safety net. Personally, I'm very pleased to have been part of the process. Speaking for the department, I can say that we support the passage of this legislation and offer our assistance as your deliberations move forward. I would also like to acknowledge the significant time and costs that were invested by individual task force members to participate in the process. The task force members acted in the interest of all Alaskans, and their work will help protect Alaska waters and make our spur response programs measure up to protecting what are arguably the most pristine and significant natural resources in the world. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would turn it over to Mr. Brian Rogers, who's in Fairbanks. Again, he was the facilitator for the task force, and he will cover the sponsor statement, give you a short overview of the bill, and do a sectional analysis. Also available online is Mr. Beck Tostevin. He's the state assistant attorney general that was assigned to this legislation. He's also available for questions, as is Paul and myself. So thank you very much, and I'll turn it over to Brian, I guess.
Mr. Rogers?
Mr. Chairman, could I remember? For the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Rogers, Information Insights. I acted as facilitator for the Task Force on Motorized Oil Transport. And the work of the task force was how to implement last year's legislation, the 31 recommendations that were achieved through unanimous agreement are contained in the report that's before you. Most of the changes are not statutory, but really are parts of the regulatory process. The legislation before you contains the minimum changes necessary to first activate the contingency planning process, second, to limit liability for certain participants in the process, the response planning facilitators, and the incident management team. And third, to enable adoption of the regulations. As noted in the testimony, the recommendations follow a market-based approach, giving affected vessels alternative means for compliance, and also importantly, phase the implementation of the legislation to spread out the costs on the regulated industry. The task force recommended this legislation with a letter of intent. The letter of intent has since been adopted as Section 1 of the bill. I think the process shows that negotiated rulemaking can work if you involve industry in determining the rules. Most of the recommendations here are already required in all of the other West Coast states, but I think Alaska's approach as set out by the task force met the goals of the task force, which were that the process in response to your work last year be realistic, be effective, be economically feasible, and be flexible. I'm going to briefly walk through the provisions of the recommendations. First, with respect to the response planning standard, the standard calls for control and containment within 48 hours. The process by which the task force feels that vessels can demonstrate that ability is to have sufficient boom to go three times the length of the vessel and the means for deployment of that boom. To meet the cleanup standard in as reasonable a time as practicable is to have a skimmer appropriate for the right type of oil in the area of operations or able to be mobilized to the area of operations within 24 hours. We also provided for alternative calculations on the size of the response planning standard for vessels that are carrying less than a full load of oil. In the area of contingency planning, it's a very streamlined process, beginning with the information required for financial responsibility that took effect last September, and a qualified individual able to make decisions in a spill event. A response action plan developed by the vessel that includes initial notification procedures, a contract with the primary response action contractor, and a contract with an incident management team, or as alternatives to those contracts, the equivalent resources brought to bear by the vessel, or a combination of contracts and equivalent resources. Also under contingency planning, we allow the development of fleet plans for groups of similar vessels or generic plans that can be set up primarily for the spot charter industry so that vessels coming into Alaska water on short notice can have a plan ready to go to be faxed out to the vessel, signed, faxed back, and ready so as to not disrupt shipping. The task force set tight time frames for review by DEC. and allowed for DEC to conduct drills and verification on vessels. We established the incident command system for oil spills as the standard to be used in incident command. On the prevention side, all the prevention measures are voluntary, but we do provide some benefits to vessels that undertake additional prevention measures. For the Alaska Railroad, the task force endorsed the risk analysis process being undertaken by the railroad and recommended that their contingency planning go through the same as for other regulated facilities. The task force recommends adoption of the legislation. I'd like to take another 2 minutes here and review the sections of the bill. Section 1, I believe, is a detailed sectional analysis that's been provided to the members of the committee as prepared by the Attorney General's office. Section 1 is the intent section and is basically asking the requiring the department to follow the recommendations by the task force as they adopt regulations. Sections 2 through 4 limit the civil liability of oil spill response action contractors, adding statutory references to the new prevention and sea plan for non-tank vessels and the railroad tank cars. Section 5 amends the definition of response action to extend the limitations on civil liability for incident management team services and response plan facilitator services. Section 6 amends last year's legislation on proof of financial responsibility to make the language identical to that for tank vessels, so as to not get the two sections of the statute subject to varying interpretations. Section 7 extends the innocent passage exemptions for vessels that are just transiting Alaska waters. Section 8 is the guts of the bill, adds the new provisions requiring the sea plans, and sets forth what the requirements would be, what the alternatives are, what types of vessels and tank cars they apply to, and authorizes DEC to adopt the implementing regulations. Section 9 gives DEC the verification authority. Section 10 requires the Lieutenant Governor certify to the revisor the effective date of the regulations, since, as I said earlier, the effective portions of the bill is phased for economic purposes. We do need to have the revisor know exactly when those provisions would take effect, and the overall act takes effect immediately. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to answer any questions you or members of the committee may have about the legislation, or can turn it back to Larry for any questions on the fiscal note.
Are there any, do you have any more presentations? Are you going to make any presentations?
Okay.
Representative Hudson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, let me say that since the Exxon Valdez, in which case I had just come into the legislature, we went through an extremely in-depth review of all of our oil spill contingency laws and liability laws and response action contractor laws. I remember carrying 3 days on the floor of the House a lot of the similar legislation. I've now read through every piece of this legislation and all of the background behind it, and I must tell you, Mr. Chairman, this is the best piece of abbreviated legislation followed by regulations according to the recommendations of the committee that met with this thing should give the state of Alaska equal protection from the non-tank vessels as it has for the tanker vessels. So I wanted to put that on the record, and I wanted to ask one question simply because there's a little ambiguity in the 400 gross registered ton designation in here. It's in the title of this bill, and of course it makes reference to the other thing. And I draw reference, and I would ask this question of Mr. Dietrich. I believe I know the answer, but I want to put on the record what this deals with. Non-tank vessel gross registered ton, Mr. Dietrich, means the gross registered ton determined by the U.S. Coast Guard, which in 33 CFR, I believe you'd agree with that, do you not?
Yes, Representative Hudson, through the chair, that is correct, and that has been memorialized in the rulemaking that was put into effect following the passage of last year's bill, Senate Bill 273, for the financial responsibility part. And so there is a defined, that term is defined now in the regulations, and there's an explicit reference to Coast Guard, I think it's CFR 13830. that does that.
And that that gross tonnage is the regulatory, as opposed to the what's the other one? I can't remember now. But the other tonnage that they refer to, it's important, I think, to make note that that is the regulatory gross tonnage definition. And I'd like the record to reflect that, if that's true, sir.
Yes, Representative Hudson, through the chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you very much. And with that, I have no further questions.
Any other questions? Representative Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Larry, are there enough responders or companies that that can handle all the different requirements? I noticed that in in this response back to the co-chair's questions here, it says there are approximately 500 non-tank contingency plan applications covering more than 900 vessels. Do we have enough C-plan responders or in the state to handle all the different entities that may or may not have a spill or an occurrence?
Yes, Representative Harris, through the chair, this has evolved since the 1990 legislation that the state's premier legislation found a spill that Representative Hudson referred to is what survived over 10 years to serve the needs of the existing regulated community is five spill response cooperatives in the state of Alaska. These five co-ops are really the backbone response capability that we have now. I would estimate that those five co-ops account for at least 80% or more of the response capability in Alaska. The task force, when their discussions on that, did not want to create a new system. Their basic thrust was we need to build on what has evolved out of that 10 years of experience as being the strongest surviving parts, and those surviving parts are the five co-ops. So they've devised a system here that builds on that capability. And so the intent here is, under the contingency plan options, one of the options is you can satisfy the requirement by belonging to one of our existing co-ops. And the intent is to strengthen those co-ops, broaden their membership base, so we end up with a stronger response with a cost spread over a greater number of participants. Now, in doing that, though, the task force is very careful so as to not be prescriptive. So there is no requirement in the law, for example, to say you have to belong to a co-op. It's not mandatory. What they wanted to do is to let the market forces work so that the most efficient system will come out of it. So if it's the most efficient for one company to belong to a co-op, that's fine. On the other hand, if another company has a fleet of, say, 25 vessels and already had some response gear, they may want to develop their own capability and go it alone so that there's a counterbalance to a co-op. If that answered your question.
One quick follow-up. Can you explain to me what the 1052 designation is under fund sources? Others, is that the 470 fund, or is that something else? Where you're getting your money from to pay for this?
Representative Harris, through the chair, the 1052 refers to the Oil Hazardous Substance Release Prevention Response Fund, and the specific account within that fund is the prevention account.
Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Larry, could you refresh for me what constitutes innocent passage under the Convention of Territorial Sea and Contiguous Zone?
Yes, Representative Mulder, through the chair. Rob Beck Tossel, but I don't know, for the Department of Law, and since that's, I think he's a little better grounded than that, if you don't mind, I would ask him to respond, if that's okay. Beck, are you there?
Did you have a question?
Yes, I did. Through the chair, this is Rex Hobson with the Department of Law. You asked about the meaning of innocent passage. Innocent passage is an international law concept which allows the vessels of foreign nations to travel, transit through one's territorial waters. And this legislation extends that concept to United States flag vessels as well. And what the concept in the bill allows is it allows a vessel to transit through our waters, but They can stop and anchor as long as it's part of normal passage, but they can't actually call on a port. They can't transfer full. You can't engage in fishing. It's an act of just simply passing through the waters. For example, a lot of vessels leave Seattle, and on the way to Asia, they go through the Great Circle route, where they go through Unimak Pass. And if you simply were going from Seattle to Asia through Unimak Pass and you entered into state waters, it would be an innocent passage. This allows an exception. You wouldn't actually have to have financial responsibility for a sea plan if your vessel was engaged in innocent passage.
Any other questions from committee members?
Just about the fiscal note when you're ready, Mr. Chairman.
I have a question. You mentioned something about spot charters going through the waters. How much time do you give them to look at the document? You said you didn't want it to slow the ship down. How do you do that?
Mr. Chairman, the provision that was put in there for spot charter, the spot charter has several options available. He can do his own streamline plan, they can do an individual plan, or more likely they can operate under a fleet plan or a generic plan. And under a fleet plan or a generic plan, they can give notice in as short as 5 days was the notice time for spot charters who are operating under that particular option. So the recommendations state that they want the department to turn around those requests in a 5-day period for spot charters.
Okay, and you mentioned something about compared these fees with other states or the cost to get these. Explain that a little bit.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, all of the West Coast states currently have legislation for non-tank vessels. I think the model that the task force probably looked at most closely was, they call it the WSMIC model, and it's in the state of Washington. And under that model, basically there's a single response capability, and so non-tank vessels that appear in state waters down there sign up with a single co-op that provides a capability for the Puget Sound area. And as they enter in, the spill response cooperative for that area provides the capacity to meet the response planning standard on their behalf. And they have fees, and they have a sign-up, and they have some other requirements. I think the task force looked at that as kind of a seed model, but Alaska, having so much more coastline, it was clear, I think, early on, we couldn't probably just have one to cover the entire state waters all the way around from Barrow and Aleutians to southeast. So although that is a relevant model, the way the task force crafted the legislation, the opportunity to have more than one of those in Alaska to serve different regions exists. For example, our co-ops right now, we have one for Cook Inlet, there's one for Prince William Sound, we have one for Southeast Alaska, we have another one that covers the non-crew traffic that makes barge deliveries all the way around to Nome. So it's kind of a regional approach that is based on the Washington State model.
Not about fiscal note, Mr. Chairman.
Pardon?
Not about fiscal note.
Let me finish this
okay.
up. You compared them and you charged them the same as Washington State, or?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, we're specializing some of the cost things here. So
My feeling is that, you know, I'm a longshoreman and I see how many ships, at least around the Ketchikan area and southeast.
Right.
And there isn't, you can't compare Puget Sound, which has so much ships going in there, and Portland, Oregon, and all down the West Coast. That's where all the ships that are servicing, coming in from other ports, are the Orient and the sort, are going through those ports. I mean, there's so much more. So tell me how you compared them.
And Mr. Chairman, yeah, Paul kind of specializes in some of the costs and the rate structure stuff, so if I could support you.
Mr. Chairman, Paul Thews for the record. In terms of determining the cost, we weren't able to put an actual dollar figure on it yet because the co-ops don't know how many people are going to join. What we did was set it up so that as people, we went through the whole equipment, in Southeast Alaska, all the equipment there, there's enough equipment to handle, including all these new vessels coming in Southeast. Same in South Central. Out West, there was a deficiency in Dutch Harbor. There was not a heavy oil skimmer out there. And then there's a schedule to go into Bethel, Nome, and Barrow over the years 2003, 2004, 2005. Those are for the tank vessels. So we agreed we'd also allow that schedule to go through. So it's a minimum of new equipment purchases, and you're right now, like Shadow out west, they have 37 members. They're likely to get 500 new vessels in this that'll help share the cost of that equipment. So it's going to substantially bring their cost down. The other reason why you see these limitations on liability is that for the vessel agents, particularly for the spot charters, you don't know until maybe 10 days before what vessel is going to come. So how are you going to handle that? That's why this language says response planning facilitator. That's for the vessel agents to have a generic plan with DEC that says these vessels, they're going to have a certificate of financial responsibility. We've got a contract with the spill response contractor and an incident management team, and all you have to do is sign with us, because DEC has already pre-authorized this plan, and you just sign with us, and in 5 days you'll have your certificate to come into Alaska. Everything was done to make this the most efficient system possible to reduce the cost, and I think the industry people on it felt that every idea they brought to make it more efficient was accepted. So although we don't know the exact cost, it's as efficient as you can possibly make it.
Okay.
That's all we could do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Larry, in reviewing the recommendations of the task force in relation to the railroad, the recommendation was that the railroad design a plan to meet the RPS of 15% of maximum fuel carried. What currently, how does that fit with where they're currently structured in terms of response?
Yes, Representative Martin, through the chair. The response planning standard that was set in SB 273 last year was the same for both the non-tank vessels and the railroad. Currently, the railroad is not otherwise under any requirements from the state to have a contingency plan or meet a response planning standard. So, but like non-tank vessels, which are not required under the Oil Pollution Act to have a contingency plan at the federal level, The railroad, I believe, has to have some things in place through, I think it's the Federal Railroad Administration, and that was looked at, but it's pretty minimal. So the capability that they have now is a capability that they've been developing over the years.
In layman's terms, could you define what RPS of 15% of maximum fuel carried means in terms of their response to be able to achieve?
Yes, Representative Mulder, through the chair. The implementation for the railroad will be much more complex, and the reason is they carry approximately 2 train loads a day. I think they have about 1.6 million gallons per train load, and the models that we looked at for the railroad and how to implement this, it will be a more complex planning effort because it's a linear type setup. It's much unlike a non-tank vessel that's roaming around on the high seas. The planning for the railroad will have to cover all the way from Seward on up through Anchorage to Fairbanks. Conceptually, the things that we've talked about with the railroad in the past is pre-positioning equipment. They have certain sidings. You can actually prioritize on a watershed basis along the alignment for the railroad, collection points and primary containment sites, so that if you have a spill in one segment of the railroad that's in a certain watershed, you can actually pre-select then a downstream point in a river that you will use as your primary containment site if you have any spill within that segment. You can then design equipment then to accomplish that primary containment, and that then essentially would be the response gear for a certain segment of the railroad then that you would use to contain and control to meet that 15% standard. It's not too unlike what we do for the Big Taps pipeline. It's segmented, usually related to a watershed basis, and then planning on a watershed basis for any spill that occurs in that watershed by going downstream far enough to get a primary containment point. If you don't get that one in time, then you actually have secondary containment points, etc. And these are all take a lot of planning, because access off of these alignments is an issue, because our access is so limited.
That's okay. And they've got to be able to respond to the 15% rapid response planning standard of 15% of the load they've carried.
Mm-hmm.
Do any railroads in Lower 48 have a similar requirement?
Representative Melvin, through the chair, we checked on, to my recollection, the task force proceeding, we did not identify any other states that had, at the state level, a contingency plan requirement for a railroad.
So this is breaking new ground for railroads?
I believe so. That's correct, Representative Mulder.
How much do you think it's going to cost the railroad to put in place this to meet this standard?
Representative Mulder, through the chair, I'm not sure if I have a good cost estimate. I would have to check the record. I believe the railroad may have made statements early on what they felt the estimated cost was to put together a plan for the entire alignment, and we could check back and retrieve that for you. I can't recall right off the top of my head. Paul, do you?
Well, I don't recall the figure either. This is Paul Foos, but what the railroad, because of the public sensitivity to, you know, having a succession of spills, was already going this direction. That's why basically we took a look at what the railroad was doing, and the task force said that's sufficient for us. And remember, this 15%, it doesn't seem like a lot, but that means you've got a starter kit and someone immediately goes. You don't wait for an insurance company to, you know, negotiate a contract with a tugboat or something. The equipment goes, and then later on, whatever additional assets are required are dispatched to it. But we looked at the railroad, and, you know, they were already under enough pressure to respond to this situation that...
to try and provide for this planning response from Fairbanks to Seward and to be able to have that rapid deployment, you'd have to have a number of outposts. It would seem to be a fairly significant cost to the railroad.
Mr. Chairman, Paul Foos, it's that response planning standard within 24 hours. Unfortunately, almost the entire railroad is on the road system. So that's what they're counting as their primary delivery. I think even with, you know, an outpost in Fairbanks and Anchorage, even for a lot of the outlying marine posts, what they're counting on is aircraft delivery of this equipment than rather than having it on site across the whole state. So if you can meet that transportation requirement within 24 hours, you'll meet the standard.
So
I would be curious about what kind of cost they're estimating.
See if we can get that.
Just, you know, when railroads nationwide are somewhat struggling to survive, and Alaska Railroad, without the help of Senator Stevens, would be in a similar or same predicament, it would anything we do to push them over the edge, I would find to be difficult.
So, Mr. Chairman, I represent Melter. The railroad has committed on SB 273 that they were going to upgrade in view of some of the incidents they had. They had already made a commitment to it. We've actually done a considerable amount of work on it with them over the last few years, and they already have a fair amount of pre-staged gear, and so we will be supplementing that. For example, vac trucks are one of the components. The other things that we've looked at with them is the idea of have a rolling car that would just simply be added to a fuel train that would provide for an initial response capability. As well, the railroad has done a lot of work with the truckers and both with the City of Fairbanks and Municipality of Anchorage to work on the hazmat side of things too. So I would applaud them for their efforts. They've been, I think, very aggressive, very cooperative, and hopefully we can continue to work with them under this standard to also work out a way to achieve it that's economic for them as well.
Representative Davies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Larry, these 500 plan reviews every 3 years, is there any cost recovery for that effort?
Representative Davis, through the chair, no, there would not be. The fiscal note is predicated on using money from the prevention account, and so the cost recovery would be applied if they had a spill, for sure. But in terms of reviewing their contingency plans, they would be the same as existing industry. It's paid for out of the prevention account.
Was there any consideration of, you know, in other contexts we've looked at, a kind of a 50-50 model where the industry pays 50% of the cost of the permit application or plan review, and and the state general fund picks up the other half, or the, in this case, the 470 fund. Was that model considered at all?
Representative Davis, through the chair. Yes, there's been a fair amount of discussion about that. With regard to the task force work, however, we didn't focus on that a whole lot and didn't examine fee structures and those kinds of things. And the whole task force deliberations were centered on the mandate that we were given in Senate Bill 273 was to figure out a system, because of the economies of scale for this industry, that's affordable. And so when we went through the task force process and are trying to use market forces to get that efficiency of costs, and got down to the end to see what it would cost them to do the reviews and stuff, the prevention account was immediately recognized as the account to go to. The other one that was discovered was GF. But recognizing, you know, the desires to control the GF expenditures, the task force, we assumed that the prevention account would be the right account to go to, and there wasn't any really any debate about that, much debate or disagreement with going that direction. The contingency plan review is a core, one of the core functions, core allowed uses of the prevention account, and it's already being used for the other industry, so this was just, it was assumed then that would be the preferred option.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any problem with the appropriateness of that. I guess my only concern is, are we going to displace any other activities that are now being supported by that account?
Yes, Representative Davis, through the chair. In none of the other committees, they requested legislative finance prepared projections for the prevention account to see if indeed that would occur. And that's not the case for the years that were projected in their report, which goes out through FY04.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Fundy?
If I understood correctly, it's a policy call that the 470 account would provide this funding, but there are contributors to the 470 account. I'm wondering why you wouldn't consider these folks should be contributors in some fashion, too.
Can I have you address that?
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Paul Thuis, Representative Bundy, through the chair. There were a lot of concerns when this legislation was passed last year about what it was going to cost the industry and some of the concerns that Representative Williams voiced earlier. And frankly, to look at this as a partnership with the state, that the industry was going to bear the largest brunt of this, to sign on with spill response co-ops, incident management teams, provide new insurance for oil spill certificate of financial responsibility. So it's partly an effort to just try to hold those costs down from being such that they might, you know, affect the economics of shipping. So I think that was a lot of it. And, you know, since that fund was available, that's why it was recommended by the task force.
Chairman, I understand that, and public policy point of view is a little inconsistency. We want the dentists to pay for their own policing, and we're not doing this. We all know the costs get passed on. We understand that.
Any other questions? Representative Croft?
I'd just like to see that legislative finance sheet on the in the prevention fund, just to reassure myself that it's not being depleted. See, that was very short, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Very small question. Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Larry, just to clearly put on the record what your intentions are, within Section 9, page 6 of the bill, it says compliance verification of non-tank vessels for trans-related facilities. The department may at reasonable times and in a safe manner enter and examine, number two, trains, railroad tracks, associated facilities, and railroad operations. What is envisioned by that language?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Mulder, yeah, if I may on that we recently had a question on that, and again, we asked Beck Tossavin to provide some clarification to that from a legal perspective, so if I might ask Beck to report on his findings on that. Beck?
Chairman, the language that was drafted there gives the department the ability to access facilities, be it a vessel or be it a railroad tank car or associated tracks and facilities to ensure compliance. compliance with the requirements of the oil pollution laws and also the sea planning requirements. People have asked whether there was an intention to create a track inspection program, and that was not with the intention of drafting it that way. It was drafted that way so that the department could have access to tracks in the event of an incident or event of inspection of the sea plan requirements. If that answers your question, I hope.
That's partially. I mean, it's obviously beyond just tracks. It's all associated facilities additionally. I just was, you know, with this inclusive language, as broad as it is, you could very well see, I mean, in the most extreme case, seeing DEC run the railroad.
Mr. Chairman, this is Paul Foose. I don't believe so, and the reason why Breck really focused in on the track aspect of it, DEC is not going to hire train track specialists to go in and you know, look at are they doing their track the right way or anything like that. But just to give you access to the premises in the event of an incident, or to check and see, you know, your certificate of financial responsibility or those type of things.
I'd like to hear the department put that on record, Paul.
Mr. Chairman, and I, on the same subject, I think we must be very careful that the vessels. I don't see DEC supplanting the U.S. Coast Guard's marine safety specialist and going out and hiring ship inspectors or anything of that nature. I think if the intent is to simply come on board and make certain that they've got the equipment, that their sea plans are up to date, people are properly trained and things of that nature, then we're all right. But I'd like to see that put on the record as well.
Mr. Chairman, in response to Representative Hudson, Representative Mulder, first of all, we do have, with regard to the non-tank vessels, we do have a detailed operating agreement. I believe it's appended to the task force report. So for non-tank vessels, for sure, we have very tightly coordinate procedures with the Coast Guard so that indeed redundancy or overlap or us substituting it does not occur. We're very sensitive to that. We've talked about this with the BC West Coast States Task Force. We believe we have one of the best working relationships between the state and the Coast Guard going on the West Coast right now. And we're very appreciative of that and recognize their role. With regard to the other issue that Beck was speaking to on the access, one of the things the department is burdened by when you have an oil spill is we do not have legal access to go anywhere to react to that spill. I think the fire marshal in the state is one of the few people that has very substantial powers if you have a burning building in terms of accessing, knocking that building down, crossing property. He's allowed to do what he needs to do to get the job done. In the oil spill business, we're not allowed to do that. In other words, if we have to go on to land to contain or control and clean up, we have to take the step to make sure we have the access to do so. And if not, in some cases, extreme cases, you might have to actually get legal access through the court if it's an emergency type situation. So that's the intent behind this is we have to, if you have an incident, our only way in many cases to get to that would be to access it via the rail, a Johnny car, get down the site. So we actually have to have the ability to travel down the right of way to get to the site to actually deal with the oil spill.
I might follow up. So Larry, this language is in there really to gain legal access in the event of a spill?
Representative Mulder, through the chair, that's correct. We're just dealing with the oil tank cars.
Would you be adverse to working on language to more clearly identify that or specify that? Because I think makes perfect sense. This is pretty broad language right now.
Representative Mulder, through the chair. Yeah, we could check back. We did have a fair amount of dialogue on that in the task force proceedings, and I would have to review. We have a fairly extensive section of the report that deals with the legal issues, and I would have to refresh. And perhaps Beck, you know off the top of your head if those discussions were included in the legal review or if they're in the transcript. It may already be on the record. Beck, do you recall?
I do not.
Mr. Chairman, this is Paul Foose. I mean, if you read just a little bit farther up in the paragraph, it says that it's in addition to the other rights of access conferred upon the department or law or otherwise to ensure compliance with the provisions of this chapter relating to oil pollution control.
the department may at reasonable time, so.
Right, but that's the concern, to ensure compliance. You know, you can take that to its logical extreme, and as I said, bring it to the point where the DEC is running the railroad. I understand the point that Larry is making. If you're going to try and gain access, and I'm not trying to diminish the importance as much as give them the authority, the power that they need for the specific purpose that they're trying to accomplish.
So, Representative Marble, through the chair, yeah, the language is it's in here, and you know, you suggest that this can be improved upon. You know, limit, it gives us the access, but it does limit what we can do that to the provisions of the chapter. The provisions of the chapter are deal with the response planning standards and compliance with it.
Representative Davies? I guess sort of two parts. And one is, I mean, the way I read this was that it was more preventative, that it was to ensure compliance with the control. So I envisioned, you know, getting access to make sure that things were in place that were supposed to be in place, certificates were in place that were supposed to be in place, that kind of thing. Am I misreading this?
So I represent Davis through the chair. No, that indeed is correct. So for example, if there's a equipment cache on a siding along the road, and we want to verify that the equipment is at that site, we need to travel by rail to get that. That's correct.
So there's really two different things that you're talking about here. You're talking about that kind of prevention aspect, but also sure. Response in the event of a spill. Correct? I mean, were we talking about both those things here?
Representative Davis, through the chair, that's correct. This is speaking specifically to prevention. It also applies to spills. I mean, we need the same legal access for spills as well.
Do you have the legal access for spills somewhere else other than this paragraph here?
Representative Davis, through the chair, if you're asking if the same language is someplace else, I don't think it is. We are required in other parts of the statute that I would have to check that requires us to get the legal access if it's not there.
And I guess the second half of my question had to do with I think that to Representative Mulder's question, you know, the limitation to oil pollution control and also the limitation only to enter and examine, I think, limits some of those. I mean, I don't think that it doesn't say to enter and commandeer, for example. So I think
it could shut it down.
I think that I don't see that. It's just to examine the operations. It doesn't say anything about being able to control the operations, unless that authority is somewhere else. That's not here, I don't see.
Representative Davis, the only reason to bring it forward is what if the department determines that they haven't got enough boom on board or something like that? The logical end would then be that they shut that rail line down, or that train down until that boom is there. Would that not be correct? I mean, so they've got this gives them the statutory or the regulatory authority. It says you may not operate in the state without these plans in place. So you then have been given the authority to shut it down, correct?
That's Representative Mulder through the chair. Yeah, that would be an extreme action that would only be taken under the commissioner's authority using an emergency order. I mean, if they're short on boom, if you will, and we let them know they're short on boom, and you get an opportunity to correct the situation.
Reasonable people using reasonable circumstances produce reasonable outcomes. Mm-hmm. My experience with government is that it's not always reasonable. Look at EPA finding, you know, this is the military example, but the EPA finding the Army in Fairbanks $16 million when they're trying to fix a power generating plant. It was not a reasonable set of people making a reasonable set of determinations. It was a political agenda driving a political desired outcome to make a political point. And what I'm trying to accomplish here is that we have reasonable allowances to do, you know, to provide reasonable opportunity to ensure public health without providing the opportunity for an unreasonable political event to occur.
Mm-hmm. So, Representative Mulder, yeah, through the chair, yeah, the department's approach to compliance to the state, because we live and work in the state, I think we're I like to think we're a little more sensitive than some of the EPA actions, but our approach is first is education. The second is technical assistance to help the operator come into compliance. Our third step is voluntary compliance. And our last step that we use then would be an enforcement action. So we work through education, technical assistance, and voluntary compliance as our primary tools for getting a job done. And 99 out of 100 cases, they work real well for us. We use compliance orders by consent is probably our primary tool. In a compliance order by consent, when you're short boom in a depot or something, we sit down with them and say, okay, you're short boom, you know, you're out of compliance. We sit down and mutually agree then to the terms of what they got to do then to get the additional boom put back into that location. So,
if I could additionally respond, you know, the decision to put this requirement and to give the department the authority to shut people down if they didn't have C plans and meet the response planning standard was made by the legislature last year when you voted 39-1 with one absent to pass Senate Bill 273. Frankly, industry had some of the very same concerns that you have, Representative Mulder, and that's why we asked for the task force. And after going through all of this, this is why they wanted to clearly define it. They had some of those same concerns that you did, and that's why they feel like they've worked through all of these. And I think you've got letters in your packet from all the various industries supporting this legislation here and attaching this report to it. Earlier, it was as a letter of intent. Your House Transportation Committee moved the letter of intent into the body of the bill because sometimes letters of intent can be ignored also. A lot of people had those same concerns, and at least for the industry people that have been involved in this, they're satisfied that those concerns have been met by this report and the letter of intent being moved into the body of the bill. That's just a general overview of how the thing happened and why people are feeling this way. We had a lot of questions. Why is industry supporting this? This is a new requirement. No, the new requirement was passed last year. Industry is supporting this because they feel they got the protections in this report for knowing what the regulations are going to be when this is implemented. That's why industry is supporting this.
And any more questions?
Yeah, if I can, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bob.
You know, I think it's a valid point that Representative Mulder is worried about. I'm not sure it's that Section 9. I mean, Section 9 is just a authority to enter and examine. It gives no authority to operate, shut down, all the other things. It's also conditioned by to ensure compliance, so it has to be related to the provisions of the chapter and has the reasonable times and safe manner. Those are all further limitations on it, but at its heart, it's just a power to enter and examine. On page 3, line 15, is the real heart of the matter that a person may not operate. And I was looking for the other provisions on, I guess I had more confidence that they would work with them if they found them out of compliance to get them back into it. But there would be the section where you talk about what they would do if they were out of compliance. But this general authority to enter and examine, they sort of have to have that authority if they're going to check out whether people are in compliance or not. So I guess I'm trying to refocus it to the prohibition on operation and what you would do in the event
right.
that you were out of compliance.
Yeah, and Representative Croft, Mr. Chairman, thank you. That's really, you know, trying to evoke reasonable response is kind of the Alaska way of resolving conflict. And this whole task force was reasonable people coming together, recognizing the problem. And that's, I understand, I support exactly what you're saying, that, you know, the method to bringing together for a reasonable result from a problem makes a lot of sense. I'm not sure, I see where you're going in terms of Section 6. I just drew the logical line between their ability to be able to enter, and the only hammer was provided in Section 6 that you may not operate. Right. So it didn't seem to have any stair step. It was like boom, boom. You know, we inspect it, you don't have it, you don't operate. There wasn't any phased approach into it.
Representative Davies?
I think that we structure a lot of our statutes that way. We, you know, it's kind of a walk softly and carry a big stick kind of approach. I mean, you have to give the agencies the authority that, you know, have the hammer there in the rare event that you have a bad actor that's refusing to comply. And I think the agencies track record in general and in the main, in the vast majority of cases, is that that's exactly what they do. There may be one or two situations where that's not the case, and we tend to get on their case in those events. But I think that you can't have a statute like this that says you got to put all this stuff in place and then not give the agencies the ability to go verify that it's there. I mean, that would be kind of crazy, too.
I'd like to move along. I think if we could go into the fiscal note. Any questions on the fiscal note? Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did have a number of questions prepared for Larry. Thank you, Larry, for trying to get these responses back as quick as possible. I circulated the answers to the members. It's behind the other conservation voters' letter, which I had nothing to do with.
Is your picture on it?
It's a two separate documents.
Response on that one?
The one question, Larry, that I have concern on, are there any other entities capable of doing review of these reports? Certainly, I know this administration is opposed to outsourcing any type of governmental or quasi-governmental function. Is it not possible, or are there other entities out there that in other locales that could do this or are doing it in other locations?
Yes, sir.
Agency?
Representative Mulder, through the chair, that was an interesting question. The closest one for the non-tank vessels, we tried to think of any cases where anybody in the Coast Guard where they may have outsourced any of their functions or activities. The state has not been involved in this arena in the past, so we couldn't think of any, on this examples on the state side. There are none that we're aware of on the Coast Guard side. I mean, we haven't get a chance to get real exhaustive on that, where they have outsourced some of their functions to a third party to perform. And we haven't had a chance to follow through with them on that to see if there's an exception or something they've done on that side that could be used as a model. But there's none that we could think of in the time we had here.
Mr. Foos, did you know of any entities out there? Are we breaking new ground with this legislation in relation to these plans and other outside entities providing this type of service?
Representative Mulder, there may be other people who could take a look perhaps at the streamlined plans and just see, make sure that they have contracts with it. The question is, as you see here from the Department of Law, is that a discretionary activity of the department? If that is discretionary regulatory decision making on their part, then this opinion says that they really can't contract that out.
How discretionary is that, Paul?
Perhaps Breck would like to address that, but for instance, for sure, just to show you an example, if someone came in and said, I'm not signing with a co-op, and I'm going to go and I'm going to get all my own equipment and have all my own people, well, then the department would really want to look at that and see, do they have all that equipment and do they have the qualified people to do it? That's very discretionary judgment. Since they've already pre-authorized the oil spill response organizations, and the question then would be, do they have a contract with them? I don't know if that's discretionary or not. Perhaps Brett Tostevin could address that issue. But that's what they seem to be saying in this opinion, is that that's discretionary. Can you take that on, Brett?
I can try. As Brett Tostevin, the opinions that talk about not delegating decision-making functions, talk about, discretionary judgment of governmental function should remain in government, and that where courts and other states have upheld delegations of to private entities or to other governmental entities, that they've upheld it if there's like a very structured oversight, and so that there isn't a lot of discretion or decision-making that's being made by the private entity. The private entity is just verifying that certain objective things are in place. You can delegate ministerial things. meaning clerical or very objective things, but when it comes to functions where the government is supposed to make a decision on whether something is adequate or not, where there's judgment involved, then that's the kind of thing that you can't delegate. It's not, really isn't a clear black and white answer, but those are kind of the general principles that the courts would look at. I mean, in this case, I think we're talking about a few extra, I think two positions or something, and those, if you did delegate to a private entity, the government employees are going to have to supervise those private entities, so there's going to be some supervisory function as well, and if you only have two positions, I'm not sure if you're gaining a great deal of cost effectiveness or not.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, the only real question I had when evaluating the fiscal note, the issue came down to two permanent and two temporary people for 2 years as the applications came in, and most of the questions, if the members look through it, revolve around what's a reasonable amount of workload for people with 500 plans, contingency plans. It appears they're going to be coming in and rolling around on a 3-year rolling average. So you're going to be having, what is that, 167 plans a year. Are most of those, Larry, going to be hitting, because you've got the initial stage, are they going to be hitting the first year and then on a rotating basis after that?
Yes, Representative Malter, through the chair, the discussion again with the task force is they wanted the phase, and so when the plans came in, they want us to automatically approve all of the plans and then stagger the reviews then so that they're staggered out over time on a 3-year cycle. So indeed, we're supposed to more or less rubber stamp them because they'll all be due on the same date, receive them then, approve them, and then individually pick them up and review them and get them on a staggered 3-year renewal cycle.
So, but I noticed, so your initial rush is going to be the first year, and that was the purpose of the temporary individuals. But you maintained them the second year as well. What was the purpose of that, Larry?
Yes, Representative Mulder, through the charity, the thinking is here on the phased approach, it'd be Ought 3 and FI Ought 3 and FI Ought 4, that the review will span a 2-year period. The actual regs will go into effect for having the plan 100, or the effective date for submitting, I believe, is 180 days after the effective date of the regs. And it's envisioned from the workload standpoint that would exceed 1 year probably to work through the cycle of getting all of the plans in the door, doing the initial reviews, getting them into a steady state mode. In addition, there's a number of other things that we're supposed to be doing when that comes in the way of technical assistance to the industry. We're supposed to provide training to them. We're supposed to initiate electronic posting of the plan. We're supposed to provide a good dose of technical assistance to the industry to understand, help them comply with the law, help them work through the process the first time. We will indeed be launching the prevention credit program during that time frame, and we will also be registering the primary response action contractors that come in the door right when we hit that threshold. So there's a number of startup activities, if you will, that will take a considerable amount of work in that first year, second year of the buildup. And then we back it down, and the estimates are we would back it down in Ought 5, we would hit the steady state level and be into a normal renewal cycle, be through the startup mode, and then it's projected two persons in the out years. One of the things I'm concerned about is the fairly aggressive review times that we have in the bill. So we will want to hit those review times once we get the system up and operating. We view those as an obligation.
Okay. It seemed, Larry, that if I might, one last question, Mr. Chairman. It seemed, Larry, that you had rather stocked numbers for travel, contractual, and supplies in relation to these positions, which by most accounts, by legislative accounts, is probably pretty generous. It will be something as we go through this process I'll continue to keep an eye on and look at whether, in fact, this is the appropriate amount or not.
Are there any more questions on the fiscal note? Representative Bundy?
I still harbor some concern about a public policy issue that requires some folks to pay for the regulation. In this case, we're not going to require
than to pay for the regulation. I don't plan to hold the legislation up, but I just think we should take note of our inconsistency in this matter.
What's the wishes of the, are there anybody out there that would want to testify on this bill? No one in the audience? Anyone on teleconference? Are there any amendments? The wishes of the bill, or the committee. Representative Hudson.
Chairman, I would make the motion to move committee substitute for Senate Bill number 16 rules with the associated fiscal notes. I believe there's two in here. Out of the committee with individual recommendations and ask unanimous consent.
Any objection? If not, so ordered. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Welcome, Mulder.
I didn't object or move to slow it down. I will be looking at whether there might be reasonable ways to, or language that might provide reasonable legal access and recourse for the department in relation to those concerns I expressed earlier.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Next, we'll go on to the Garvey bonds. What I ask the Oh, okay. I just didn't want to ruin my average.
Hey, Kurt.
I just did a surprise that they were paying into the 470 fund there. Well,
they are. They are.
That is surprising.
They are. I'm very confident they don't want to.
An invitation.
Yeah. What can we do?
Con.
Who do you invite? What I'd like to.